A humble lunch meat became an American classic when it acquired two names.
My baloney has a first name, it's O-S-C-A-R. My baloney has a second name, it's M-A-Y-E-R. Oh, I love...
On Monday, Oscar G. Meyer, the retired chairman of his family's meat products company, died at the age of 95. He was the third Oscar Meyer in the family, the namesake of bologna, the patron saint of wieners, the captain of the Wiener Mobile, a name that was special in part because it sounded so good in song.
Oh, I'd love to be an Oscar Meyer wiener. That is what I truly like to be. 'Cause if I were
Meyer Meats have been around since the 1890s, and while the brand is now a division of Kraft, its captivating little jingle still spread as fast as the tempting smell of the bratwurst Oscar's grandfather sold from a horse-drawn wagon in Chicago. And, best of all, one of those iconic tunes taught us all how to spell baloney.
Oh, I love to eat it every day, and if you ask me, I'll say, 'cause Oscar Meyer has a way with B-L-O-G-N-A. How's that?
Tomorrow it's Science Friday with Ira Flatow. Lynn Neary will be here on Monday. I'll see you again on Tuesday. Have a great weekend. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.
And he mentioned that survey showing some skepticism about the economic stimulus plan. One survey says President Obama's overall approval rating has slipped below 50% in Ohio, the economically troubled swing state that sometimes decides presidential elections. This morning, we've called Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio. Senator, welcome back to the program.
Steve, glad to be back. Thank you.
So what do you think is causing less than half of your constituents to support the president's course?
Well, first of all, it's one poll. I'm not sure that it's reflective of exactly what's happening in Ohio. But people, of course, are frustrated. People hope to see stimulus, the kicking in of the stimulus and meaning more jobs and more economic activity sooner. And you also have people like the minority leader who's from Ohio saying that none of the stimulus money has been spent yet and no projects, when in fact there have been more than 50 projects already in Ohio. Beginning in small towns and big cities and suburbs, highways, water and sewer, those things are starting to happen. But as David said and as Chris Farrell said earlier, they're clearly this economy's from policies of the last 10 years clearly is worse than people thought it was going to be back in January or February.
Well, the president has said he wouldn't do anything differently. Do you think the president could have done something differently?
Well, I would have wanted to write it's a different stimulus package, but it's the best we could get at the Senate at that time to get a bipartisan stimulus package through. I would have wanted to see more infrastructure spent more quickly. But it's clear to me now that there is a lot of money, as Wessel just said. There's still a lot of money in the pipeline. I think you're going to be seeing some better news in the future, although this recession is deep and long, and we're not going to get great news in the future, but we're going to see in the next few months more projects, more dirt fly, if you will, in these shovel-ready infrastructure projects, water and sewer, highways, broadband, all that I think we're going to see in the months ahead.
Well, Senator Brown, granting that not all the money has been spent yet, it may be a bit premature to talk about passing another stimulus plan. You know that some economists think that even if all this money is spent, it's not going to be enough. That is one economic view. Do you think there is any support among your colleagues in the Senate for a second stimulus at some point in the near future?
I think the interviews you've done this morning point exactly correctly to how people on the Hill think. I mean, I think people in the House and Senate and most of the public is thinking, and particularly in my state, and whether it's Dayton or Akron or Cleveland, that let's see how this stimulus is working. Once more money's in the pipeline, especially in the next couple of quarters, then we will reassess, but I don't think you make a decision on a stimulus yet when this one is not played even 50% out yet. You can't really make a decision on what you do next of a big public investment. I mean, we plan for the future, but in terms of voting both houses and the president signing a new big public investment, I think it's premature to make those plans.
Are some of your colleagues looking at the months that it may take for the stimulus to work, looking at the unemployment rate, and also looking at the 2010 election calendar and getting a little nervous?
Well, there's frustration, and almost nobody really thought this economy would be quite as bad as it is, and And my state's been in recession, as Ohio has Michigan and a small number of states for a longer period than the rest of the country. But every state, virtually every state except for a small number of energy states, are hurting badly, obviously. And the depth of this economy has frustrated people in both parties and both houses, as it has my constituents in Zanesville and in Defiance. So I think that we clearly, I'm not at all practicing patience or counseling patience, but I think that we need at least for a few months to play this out, to push this spending through the pipeline is a little more quickly than the administration's done, and see where we are in October, November, and if we need to consider a new stimulus, then we do.
Very briefly, Senator, is your party going to be in political trouble if you've still got a 10% unemployment rate when you get close to election time next year?
Well, who knows? I mean, everybody in my state, even those who are frustrated with the new president and what's happened in terms of the economy, understand that it was the last decade of economic policies that got us into this terribly deep recession. Bad trade policy, bad tax policy, deregulation of Wall Street, no real interest in manufacturing policy. Those are the things we need to do medium and long term, trade, tax, and manufacturing policy. And I think that Congress is going to get very serious about that as soon as we begin to work our way out of this recession.
Senator, thanks very much.
Glad to be with you, Steve.
That's Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio.
We have a baseball team here in Los Angeles that has not one, but two Hall of Fame announcers. There's Vin Scully in his 60th season, and back in 1959, Scully was joined by a counterpart, Jaime Harin, who became the voice of the Dodgers for Spanish-speaking fans.
Los Dodgers llamados a ganar esta tarde para evitar...
And take a listen to those R's.
Play ball, fanáticos, avanzamos al cierre. Gran sabor, llena menos. Viene. Viene y le rozó el uniforme.
Recently, we went to Dodger Stadium and started the game right there in the broadcast booth next to Jaime Harin. Harin has a great view of the game just over home plate. In front of him are pages of statistics. Like most baseball announcers, he keeps score with just a pencil and paper.
Un inning en los libros, 0-0, Marineros y Dodgers.
Jaime Harin started in broadcasting when he was just a teenager in Quito, Ecuador. He arrived in the U.S. the same day Sandy Koufax debuted in the big leagues, June 24th, 1955. At the time, Harin didn't even know who Koufax was.
I never saw a baseball game in my life until I came to this country. Because in Quito, we don't play baseball, they play soccer.
Still, a Spanish language station here in L.A. took a chance on the young Harin and gave him 1 year to learn baseball.
He was reading every newspaper, every magazine about baseball, trying to grasp the sport as much as possible. And then I was listening to Vin Scully and Jerry Dugg doing the games, and that's how I started. I started doing a couple of innings first, then little by little I improved.
Did Vin Scully, even then, well into his time as being identified as the announcer for the Dodgers, did Vin Scully help you?
Oh, a lot. At the beginning, we didn't travel with the team. We used to do the home games, and we used to recreate the road games. And in those days, there were no TV, except one day a week on Saturdays. So we had to translate simultaneously, listening to Vin and Jerry on the line, and we were doing the games. And he was so helpful because he knew that it was a very tough job to do it. So before the game, he usually will tell me the lineups in advance, will tell me facts and some information that was very, very valuable.
Basically, you were not seeing the game. You were hearing Vin Scully, who was seeing the game. Now, you said simultaneous
exactly.
Translation.
We had to listen to him. We had a big reel of background noise going all the time for 2 hours. So in every game, in the third inning, you will hear peanuts, peanuts, peanuts. So then we had, in those days, we had cartridges for noise. So we had a cartridge for a single, another cartridge for a double, another for a triple, another for a home run.
Now, when you started out in 1959, there were 6 to 8% of the people in the stadium were Latino.
Latinos. Now it's about 38 to 40, 42% here in Dodger Stadium.
Was there a moment where the Latino fans just jumped up?
I would say that 1981 was the year that really, really created many thousands of thousands of thousands of new baseball fans, thanks to Fernando Valenzuela. The Fernando Mania was something unbelievable. I would say that he is the baseball player that created more new baseball fans than any other baseball player.
Fernando Mania, why was it so dramatic when Fernando Valenzuela came on the scene?
I think several factors. First of all, baseball was dying for a hero. Then here comes this 19-year-old kid, a little bit chubby, long hair, Indian features, couldn't speak a word of English, comes here and starts pitching like the angels. He had such a charisma. People that were really didn't care about baseball in Mexico, Central America, and South America, because of Fernando, they became fans, and they have been great supporters of baseball. I don't think there is another segment of population that supports baseball more than the Latinos.
Do you announce the game differently, do you think, than your English-speaking peers because you're reaching out to populations, like all through Mexico?
Yeah. I am not a screamer. I am trying to be very fair with everybody. I try to keep a nice pace. But, of course, I have to prepare probably more because I'm reaching Latinos, and I try to give them more information regarding the Latino ball players and things regarding to our culture.
You're pretty famous for the way you, we say, trill your R's.
Well, I...
Say my name. Rene.
Rene. Well, I try to respect the proper names. I don't change it. If it's a French name, should be pronounced as a French. And I don't like when they try to anglicize the Spanish names, for instance. I don't know why they say Gomez instead of Gomez. Perez instead of Perez. That's the proper way to do it. So I try to do the same thing in English. I know that I have a very heavy accent, but I try to pronounce the way it should be pronounced in English.
51 seasons. Vin Scully's a little ahead of you here on this one, but the two of you are still here.
Sometimes I think and I don't believe it. Really, to be honest with you, where 50 years have gone? Because I love so much what I do. Really, really. I could do 2 games a day very easily, 7 days a week. The big problem becomes the family. To leave the family alone for such long periods of time during the road trips are very tough. My wife, she deserves a medal. Blanca, thank you very much, and God bless you. But 50 years are gone, and I love what I do.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Very kind of you. Thank you very much.
By the way, during the first few years of that Fernando Mania that Jaime Jarin talked about, he served as Fernando Valenzuela's translator until the pitcher learned English. These days, they're still together in the booth, with Valenzuela doing color commentary and Jaime Jarin, the Spanish voice of the Dodgers.
Y se une ahora el equipo de transmisión de radio en español de los Dodgers de Los Ángeles, nuestro analista de lujo, el chef Fernando Valenzuela. ¿Qué tal, Fernando?
¿Qué tal, Jaime? ¿Cómo está? Buenas tardes. Saludos para todos.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. As a candidate, President Obama proposed linking teacher pay to student performance. Now, his administration is moving aggressively to make it happen. Last week, Education Secretary Arne Duncan challenged the National Education Association, the nation's largest teachers union, to drop its opposition to merit pay. As more and more Democrats line up behind the idea, teachers may have no choice. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan stood before the National Education Association last week and listed some of the proposals the Obama administration intends to use to shake up public education, giving entrepreneurs a shot at creating innovative programs, funding more charter schools, expanding school choice, and attracting more talented people to the teaching profession. And the NEA has to do its part, Duncan said. It's not enough for teachers to defend their job security, tenure, or compensation.
I came here today to challenge you to think differently about the role of unions in public education, because when thousands of schools are chronically failing and millions of children are dropping out each year, we have to do something differently.
The NEA can start, Duncan said, by endorsing pay for performance, the idea that teachers should be rewarded based on their students' performance and test scores. Some teachers in the audience, though, weren't buying it.
Quite frankly, merit pay is union busting, and it's an attempt to divide and conquer that the NEA will not accept.
No way, said Tanya Kapner, a special education teacher.
We need to make sure that we do not have our pay tied to a test score.
That's the core issue that inevitably draws the ire of teachers, having their pay tied to their students' performance. What about teachers who work with learning disabled students or kids who don't know English, asked Scott Miller, an English teacher from Hawthorne, California.
Secretary Duncan, how can anyone possibly suggest that my family's paycheck or my performance evaluation be based on their test scores?
Test scores alone should never drive teacher evaluation, Duncan responded.
But to remove student achievement entirely from evaluation, I think is illogical and indefensible.
The crowd grew quiet, except for a few boos, which Duncan used to lighten the moment.
You can boo, just don't throw any shoes, please. You're welcome to boo.
Duncan reminded the audience that performance pay also rewards teachers for mentoring, for teaching in high-poverty schools, and taking tough assignments. But his parting message to the NEA was blunt. President Obama has put pay for performance at the top of his education agenda, and the Department of Education has already set aside at least $200 million in grant money to develop pay for performance plans. 132 school districts have applied. Duncan's not so subtle suggestion was that opposing merit pay is akin to defending the status quo.
Well, I can tell you right now that we are not satisfied with the status quo. We want to shake things up.
NEA President Dennis Van Roekel.
There are some things that we readily agree on performance pay, but it has to be bargained and negotiated at the local level. It just can't be imposed from the outside.
I disagree.
That's Congressman George Miller, a Democrat from California, and the powerful chairman of the House Education and Labor Committee. Like most Democrats, Miller is a union ally until the merit pay issue comes up. 2 years ago, the NEA's California affiliates helped kill Miller's plan to insert a pay-for-performance plan into federal education law.
They actively opposed it, opposed me personally, but I think they now understand this is a direction that the country must go in. There has to be a linkage of the performance of students and the teachers so that we can see what's taking place in the schools.
The NEA leadership is having to change its position on pay for performance because in places where it exists, Miller says it's been good for kids and teachers have embraced the idea. But most of all, says Miller, the NEA will come around because the President of the United States and both parties in Congress are behind it. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. In L'Aquila, Italy today, President Obama chaired a meeting of leaders representing two very different groups. On one side, the G8 industrialized countries. On the other, nearly a dozen developing nations. They were trying to agree on common targets in the effort to reduce global warming. The president reported substantial progress, but the two groups failed to agree on one crucial point, setting limits for carbon emissions. From L'Aquila, NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
President Obama called climate change the defining challenge of our time. And with rising temperatures, already melting ice sheets and swelling oceans, he said, it's a problem that cannot be ignored.
Every nation on this planet is at risk. And just as no one nation is responsible for climate change, no one nation can address it alone.
Yesterday, the major industrial nations that make up the G8 agreed to collectively reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by mid-century. Today, the talks turned to developing nations such as India, China, and Brazil. Those countries joined the G8 in saying global temperatures should not be allowed to rise more than 2 degrees Celsius. But without more help from wealthy countries, they refuse to commit to limiting their own greenhouse gases. Alden Meyer of the Union of Concerned Scientists says without that cooperation, no effort to fight climate change can succeed.
Even if we totally eliminate carbon emissions in the North by 2050, there needs to be a substantial reduction from business as usual by the remaining developing countries of the world. To achieve that, they need the financing and the technology assistance to grow their economies in a sustainable way.
A draft proposal that would have provided developing countries with $400 million to cut emissions and adapt to the effects of climate change was dropped from the final declaration at today's meeting. Meyer says without that kind of funding from rich countries, the developing world is reluctant to sign on.
They don't have confidence based on this meeting and the last year and a half of opportunities that have been missed by the G8 countries. They don't want to be on the hook with no support to help achieve it.
Administration officials say there's still time to negotiate cuts in developing countries' greenhouse gases before a UN climate summit in Copenhagen in December. They acknowledge that may require both technical and financial support. Deputy National Security Advisor Dennis McDonough says the Obama administration has made finding cleaner forms of energy a top priority.
And I think our challenge is to be the first country to not only green our own economy here, but also to lead the way on green exports to countries like India and China that want to see the kind of low carbon growth that is only going to come with new innovation.
President Obama said this week's talks in Italy have produced a good start in the fight against global warming, but he acknowledged that fight won't be easy. Climate change legislation in the U.S. only narrowly passed the House last week, and it still faces an uphill battle in the Senate.
We can either shape our future or we can let events shape it for us. We can fall back on the stale debates and old divisions, or we can decide to move forward and meet this challenge together. I think it's clear from our progress today which path is preferable and which path we have chosen.
Mr. Obama said because the problem of climate change is largely man-made, people have the power to solve it. The question, he said, is whether they have the courage to do so. Scott Horsley, NPR News, L'Aquila, Italy.
Finally, it's summertime, and in addition to perhaps going to the Comic-Con, many of us will be headed to the theater to beat the heat and catch a movie or two. But before you buy your popcorn, you might want to check your political correctness at the door, because some of the season's biggest blockbusters may offend as much as they entertain. The new Transformers movie is taking heat for its jive-talking, if we can say that, twin robots. Many critics have decried them as stereotypical black male thugs. Coming out tomorrow is the new film Bruno, starring Sacha Baron Cohen. He's already famous for that controversial Borat character. Now he's playing Bruno, who is a flamboyant, gay, Austrian television reporter. And some people see it either as smart social commentary or a gay minstrel show. So joining me to talk about these varying perspectives are Eric Dagans. He's TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times in Florida. He joins us from St. Petersburg. Also with us is Armand White. He's the chief film critic for the New York Press. He's the chairman of the New York Film Critics Circle, and he joins us on the phone from New York. Welcome. Thank you both.
Hello, Michelle.
Glad to be here.
Eric, let me start with you. You recently took your children to see Transformers, Revenge of the Fallen. I'm going to play a short clip with two of the characters. These are the twin robots, Skids and Mudflap. They've drawn a lot of criticism on the blogs and in some of the film critics in the papers. Here they are. They're talking about the lead character played by Shia LaBeouf. Here it is.
Hey, you know the glyphs? The symbols that have been rattling around in my head?
Ooh, that's old school, yo. That's the Cybertronian.
Oh, that's some serious stuff.
They gotta mean something, like a message, or like a map. Like a map to an energon source. Can you read this?
We don't really do much reading. Not so much.
Well, if you can't read it, we gotta find somebody who can.
That was Shia LaBeouf, by the way. I'm sorry about that. So, Eric, funny or offensive?
Not particularly funny to me. What's interesting to me about some of these stereotypes is how enduring they are in film and television. And they tend to crop up when we think we've got this whole thing licked. You know, we've inaugurated a black president. We're in a post-racial society. So all of a sudden, it's cool to create these comical characters who just happen to sound like young black males, don't like to read, and fight all the time. It's just I found it particularly irritating because these characters don't really have a lot to do with the story. I'm reminded of Jar Jar Binks, which is also a controversial character from the Star Wars films. They're incidental to the story. They're supposed to be comic relief, And yet somehow they wind up sort of the crystallization of all these awful stereotypes that we have about black people.
So I'm just going to push you for a minute. Annoying can be different than racist. So do you think that they are racist?
I think that they're insensitive. Racist is a really strong term. What I think they've done is they've tried to create these characters that feel like some sort of reflection of sort of a modern hip-hop sensibility as a comic relief. And I think at some point in the process, you would have hoped that somebody tapped director Michael Bay on the shoulder and said, hey, look, you know, these robots seem like young black men. Mm-hmm. but either somebody did that and he disregarded it, or they didn't realize it until they were so far in the process they were committed to it.
Okay. Armin, funny or racist, or what's your take?
Well, I thought it was not especially funny, but I did think they were cute. And I'd like to remind viewers and listeners that Michael Bay, who is the director of the movies Bad Boys and Bad Boys 2, is quite conversant with black slang, black humor, particularly hip-hop slang and humor. And he's got a sense of humor about it. And I think he understands, or he expects his audience, who are familiar with his work, would get it, and get it without being offended by it. It's funny to me, though, that people take this to be a black stereotype when the lingua franca of pop culture today comes from hip-hop, and those hip-hop stereotypes, if we can say hip-hop stereotypes without implying any kind of ethnicity, are common among black children, black youth, as well as Asian youth, Latino youth, white youth in America.
Do you think it's the robot aspect that takes it, that deracializes it?
I think the robot aspect makes it inoffensive, helps to make it inoffensive, but it's basically funny. I think most young people would get it. I think only...
Well, get what? What are they getting?
Would get the humor. Would get the fact that this is how kids and those the twin Autobot characters are supposed to be kids.
I don't get why it is that they don't read. What? I don't get that. Why is it that they have to not read? I mean, obviously, it's, you know, an artist can do whatever he wants with his film, but do you know what I mean? I think that's the thing that particularly, I think, pushes people's buttons, because as you said, the lingua franca can be, hip-hop is a global phenomenon, but the...
Well, I wasn't, the idea of them not reading didn't affect me one way or another. I read them as characters who were full of energy, full of misdirected energy, mischievous as kids often are.
Okay.
And I'm always a little careful about trying to assign the term racist to movie characters who are not human beings.
Sure, let's move on to another thing.
You know, I would just pop in and say, number one, just because something's insensitive doesn't mean it can't be entertaining. And I think part of the problem with stereotypes is that often they are very entertaining, and that's why it's so hard to deal with them. And I think to pretend that hip-hop culture is not a product of black culture and say that because a lot of white people like it, it's not a product and a symbol of black culture is also misdirected.
Let's talk about another film that's stirring up criticism and praise. It hasn't come out to the public yet. It will this weekend. But Armand, you wrote about Sacha Baron Cohen's new film, Bruno, and he stars as the flamboyantly gay Austrian fashion reporter who comes to the U.S. to interview people for his television show. I'm going to play a short clip. Here he is at boot camp.
What's up with the scarf?
That is like it's my own thing.
Let me introduce you to somebody. Captain Miles.
Stand at the position of attention, candidate.
That is not part of the uniform, candidate. You need to take that off.
This outfit is too matchy-matchy as it is, and so I was just trying to break it up with some simple horizontal lines.
Do you have an attitude, candidate? Do we detect an attitude?
Everything
we
do.
She's got an attitude.
What?
Sir,
what?
Mr. Candidate, you just called me
just
she?
Called
Get out, candidate.
Do it.
Now. What type belt is that, candidate? What is that?
D&G.
What is D&G?
Dolce & Gabbana. Hello?
Hello? Hello?
Armin, funny or offensive?
Offensive and not very funny at all. I think we're in bad shape here when it comes to what people call political humor. Since I think with Borat and Sacha Baron Cohen's other alter ego, Ali G, and now with Bruno, he isn't a comic with a real sense of politics. What he is he's a form of ambush artist. And I find that particularly offensive. Whether his subject is left wing or right wing politics, whether it's Asian or rather Muslim politics, or whether it's gay politics or gay behavior, I think he's an not funny. I think he's just an offensive opportunist comic.
Eric? Funny
well,
or
I
offensive?
Mean, what's weird about it is it could be both. It could be funny and offensive. And in a weird way, that's the point. I mean, what is different to me about Bruno, and I will allow that I have not seen the film. I've only seen clips of it. What is interesting to me about this film is that the whole point of this character and the whole point of what Sacha Baron Cohen is doing with the character is to get in people's faces with the most offensive stereotypes about gay people that he can embody in one character and then put them into situations where he thinks that it might start trouble with people who aren't aware of what he's doing. And in that fission, in that reaction, in that combustibility, I think he's hoping to get both humor and he's also hoping to reveal something about the people that he's interacting with. Now, you can judge whether or not he's actually done that. I mean, I think what the reviews are saying about the movie is that he hasn't really done that. Mm-hmm. What he's done is create a really offensive character and just kind of put him in these situations that are not funny and don't reveal anything. I think there's a difference between that and creating characters as comic relief that just happen to be stereotypical.
I see what you're saying. And Armin, I'm going to give you the last word because I gave Eric the first word. I think what Eric is saying is that Bruno is conscious social commentary, whereas Transformers seems to contain these mundane, unintentional stereotypes. I'm going to give you the last word on Bruno. And I also want to know if you can engage that in the minute we have left, is why do these movies, Transformers is already very successful, took in $300 million already. Bruno is anticipated to do well as well. Why do these movies do well?
Well, I would say immediately that instead of responding to what the film is as a media item, if one actually sees the film, you understand it's not what Sacha Baron Cohen intends to do that is important. It's what he actually does. And what he simply actually does, in fact, is ridicule and humiliate people. It's as simple as that. I think that audiences respond to Transformer in the enormous way they have because it is a work of art. It has aesthetic qualities, which Sacha Baron Cohen's movies never, ever have. Mm-hmm. And it's entertaining. Transformers is entertaining in a way that's almost astonishing. People respond to it honestly without bringing in unnecessary political correctness.
Forgive me, we have to leave it there. I thank you both. Armin White is the chief film critic for the New York Press, is the chairman of the New York Film Critics Circle. Eric Dagans is the TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times. I thank you both so much.
Thank you.
That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin. This is Tell Me More.